is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
And we are back with Nation Radio at 6 minutes after 1 o'clock. And of course, this is hour number two. We're going to be talking to Jonathan Willis. So,
What you talking about?
How are you, Jonathan?
I'm doing great, Alan. How are you today?
Good. I've been thinking about you and Ernest Hemingway. And the reason is because Hemingway had a unique way of going about his business when he wasn't writing anything. And I'm thinking about the lockout, and I worry about you if you have Hemingway's habits when you're away from the typewriter.
I not only do I not have Hemingway's talent, but I don't have his habits either, so no problem on any score there.
Okay. I was just worried. I thought this is where it went downhill for Hemingway when the lockout happened. What are you going to write about if there's a lockout, buddy?
I think we'll probably spend a lot of time in Oklahoma City. The thing about a lockout is if you look at the last one in 2004-05, a lot of what happened the next year really was generated by that lockout. So looking at the Oilers specifically, Sean Horkoff before the lockout was kind of a 40-point player that most people pegged as a third liner. And Alex Hemsky hadn't really emerged. Those guys both went to Europe. They had great years in Europe. They came back. They had superb seasons in Edmonton. The team Edmonton met in the finals, Carolina. Eric Staal was a 35-point rookie the year before the lockout. He went down to the lockout, played a point per game over a full AHL season, came back and was a 100-point guy for Carolina when they made their run to win the Cup. So I think, as much as I'd like to watch NHL hockey next year, if there is a lockout, there are still going to be stories, and it's something we want to keep an eye on so that we can kind of project what these guys are going to do when they come back after the lockout.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that because it really did. I remember the Edmonton Roadrunners team, Guy Fleming and I were talking about it, the Rafi Torres, Jarrett Stoll, Kyle Brodziak had a big year that year. What maybe was it? I guess the AHL was a better league that year then, and these kids were allowed to develop maybe away from the microscope.
I think so, and I'm a big fan of the Detroit method of developing players, just where you put them in a position where they can succeed and you don't move them up until they're ready to succeed at the next position. And it's something that Edmonton has struggled with over the years. So when there is a lockout, it forces them to kind of put these guys at a lower level of hockey. I mean, the AHL during a lockout is very, very good hockey, but it's not the same as playing full-time NHL minutes either. And I tend to think that's good for players. It's good for their development. Even the high-end guys on the Oilers right now who are without question legitimate NHLers, I can't see it hurting them. I think it's a helpful step, and it's too bad that it takes a lockout to bump guys down to the minors and get them into that place where they can really excel. But it's interesting to watch.
It would also, I think, Tyler Pitlick, Curtis Hamilton, those types of players, it would possibly force them to work hard again for playing time, which isn't always a bad thing.
Yeah, that's the one thing. I think you have to worry a little bit that a guy like a Curtis Hamilton gets lost in the mix. But I think the true talent, the really high-end guys that are going to have careers are going to play well anyway.
I'm going to go. I've got a couple of email and PM questions I'm going to throw at you. This one comes from Cactus saying, is or was there a reasonable and not overly expensive way for the Oilers to upgrade their defense this offseason? Some people maintain that Tambellini should have done more, while others, like myself, have defended him on the grounds that we want no part of $5 million plus for guys like Weidman or trades like Foligno for Mathot. What's your thought on that?
Yeah, I tend to agree that a lot of the high-end defensemen were quite expensive. He mentions Mark Mathot. That was a big payment by Ottawa to bring him in. And do you really want Dennis Weidman inked for 5 years and $5 million plus? I don't know that you do. With that said, I don't think there's a real excuse for not doing more than they have. Every year, there's always some kind of bargain guy they can get. And in the Oilers' case, they've got a lot of names, but they don't really have that mid-range talent They do have guys, but they could use more. They've got in Sutton and Peckham and Potter, they've got eight defensemen, but those bottom three are all really six, seven, eight guys. You don't want them playing big minutes on your depth chart. So what the Oilers could have done is done something like what Nashville did. They went out and signed Scott Hannon for $1 million. He'd be an upgrade, I think, to that position. And then there's a free agent like Michael Roosevelt, who has not yet signed, who probably wouldn't cost that much. So there are bargains to be found, and I think the Oilers should have done a little bit more, but we'll see. I mean, landing Justin Schultz is an upgrade, and it's hard to fault them for landing the most coveted free agent on the market.
I agree with you totally. I think the Schultz deal, the problem with Schultz is we haven't seen him. So
yeah.
It's easy to go, oh yeah, no, we got him, and then forget about him 5 minutes later, which is what I've done all summer. That's a nice addition. There's no doubt about it. You wrote a 10 points article on Oilers Nation, and there were a couple that I wanted to get to. First of all, it kind of dovetails with what we talked about a minute ago. There was a great passage about the Red Wings and their procurement department over the years. Glenn Sather used to do this too, where the current Oilers don't do it. They're all about procuring young talent. But the Red Wings do a really nice job. You use Dan Cleary as an example. There are others of maybe bringing what we might call scrap heap players or replacement level players into training camp, offering them a small contract or maybe even just an invite, and then grabbing the best of those and upgrading their team that way.
Yeah, and Chris Draper, Dan Cleary, there's tons of examples. The quote that I ran with from Ken Holland was about Slava Fetisov, who was a healthy scratch in New Jersey. He played just a handful of games in 94, and they traded a third-round pick for him. And he was a big factor in the 1997 Stanley Cup win. He was an integral part of the 98 team that won the Cup. He was a useful player. I think he scored at a point per game pace after they picked him up. And I guess what I'm getting at is these guys don't always work out. So you can't say, oh, you got to sign these guys and he'll, you can't always project best case scenario. But what Detroit does is they grab veterans. They don't ask them to do too much. They put them in the lineup. And if they work, they advance them. They don't just write a guy off because somebody else wrote him off. And I think sometimes there's a tendency to do that. And the nice thing is, as long as you're not overpaying, like when Edmonton signed Cam Barker, they paid premium dollars. It was only a one-year deal, but they paid premium dollars to bring him in. That's not what you want. You want to bring these guys in for what their value is now, and then if they exceed that, great. It's all gravy.
The other item that you mentioned in that article was about Ben Eager, who is an interesting player because, you know, he skates so well, Jonathan. And,
yep.
You know, I mean, when he scored a goal, I can't remember what game it was, but he just stood in front of the net and just cranked the goalie pads until the puck went in the net. And I'm like, see? that's the problem with Saw Him Good, right? This is a guy who, you know, has a value. He's big. He's strong. He's a fourth line guy. But expecting him to project farther up the lineup or inserting him into the fifth spot in the batting order is just not a good plan.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I know exactly what you're talking about because there was half a dozen games last year where you watched Ben Eager and you said, wow, this is a legitimate power forward. Why doesn't this guy get top 6 minutes? Because that's how good he was in that individual game. But I mean, he's 28 years old. He's played 400-odd NHL games. This is what he is. He has those games where he's really good because he does have the physical talent to be an impact player, but he hasn't been able to put it together. And at some point you say, okay, this is what he is. And I think we're there with Eager. He's a guy who will have those good games. Then he's a guy who will have terrible games and take penalties. I think back to the New York Islanders game last year, about the middle of the year, I think he had four minors in that game. He basically handed the game to them with his penalties. And that's part of the package. You put it all together, he's a decent fourth liner who can move up the lineup some nights, and some nights he's a liability.
And he's not J.F. Jacques, so it's an upgrade. Right?
Yeah, he's right. Not JF Jacques, so that's a good thing.
Yeah, no, sure. And I mean, Jacques had injuries and other things, so I'm not being negative about JF Jacques, but Ben Eager, you know, can hold down a fourth line job, score 8 goals a year, play 6 minutes a night, and the Oilers value that. So there's a value there.
And Jacques might have been a better player, too. Like you said, that he had that back injury, and I think it just destroyed him.
Yeah, no, it did for sure. Changing gears a little bit, we're with Jonathan Willis from Oilers Nation, Cult of Hockey and Copper and Blue. NHL numbers, I talked to Derek Zona about this. The site is ripping up the summer, and I love these, and I call them Bill James abstract review and preview issues. These are outstanding. For those who haven't read them, I'm trying to encourage them to go there. Tell me about why you value them, and I'll tell you why I value them.
Are we talking about the team manual?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because the people that we have writing there are all very smart people. There's a long list of names. I won't list it off, but they're bright people. They really put teams under a microscope, and they examine them from a perspective that isn't generally present in mainstream publications, where they're looking at what happens when a team scores this many goals and allows this many. What does that mean going forward? What happens when you remove a player like a Lidstrom from a team like Detroit? What happens historically when that occurs? And I think it's a unique perspective. And the nice thing about it is because there's such a diverse set of writers doing it, you get a different perspective with each piece. So I find myself reading this, even a team I'm relatively familiar with, and it makes me think about them in new ways.
Well, I love I think it's Sharon has the Habs one out today, and he did a great job of saying what they had done in the first half and what they didn't do in the second half, and then what they needed, and it brought to a crescendo where they said they basically did nothing. And it really, to me, it's a thumbnail sketch. It's about maybe a 10-15 minute read, but it just gathers all the information up in one place and then puts it there so you can kind of have it in concrete terms.
Well, yeah, and I mean, it's impossible to be really dialed into all 30 teams unless you have basically unlimited time. So this gives you an opportunity to just quickly get a thumbnail sketch and come away with a better understanding.
The other thing I wanted to talk to you about is the top 25 under 25, which is at Copper and Blue. You took part in that. That's an interesting exercise, isn't it?
Yeah, I actually started the Copper and Blue a few years ago, as you undoubtedly remember, but Derek Zona, of course, and Scott Reynolds are doing a fantastic job running the site now, and the one thing that I come back for every 6 months is the top 25 ranking. And it's an interesting exercise because it looks at all the players under 25. So your typical prospect list just looks at the prospects in an organization, and it doesn't really give you an appreciation for the young depth on a team. Whereas when you go through all the players under that age, you really kind of understand where they are.
Well, I was interested in your specific top five or so, and I'll tell you why. As much as I love Taylor Hall, and I think that Neil Yakupov is going to be an outstanding player, the one guy who is kind of a super freak, to borrow from Rick James, is Ryan Nugent Hopkins, because as much as we know about him, there's a lot that we, like, if he ends up doing what he did this past year again, who could be in front of him, right?
Yeah, and I was the only guy who ranked Ryan Nugent Hopkins number one. Everybody else had Hall number one, and it was based on that long-term upside primarily. Because his ability this past year was just off the charts good. His ability to impact a game offensively at the age of 18 was better than what we saw from Taylor Hall in his rookie year. It's better than what we saw from Eberle at an older age in his rookie year. It's really unparalleled, even with the list of talent that this team has. And especially later in the year, because Tom Rennie, one of the things he did was he made Nugent Hopkins' ice time tougher as the year went on. He started him off with lots of time in the offensive zone, weakest opposition he possibly could. And as the year went on, the opposition got a little better, a little better, a little better. And he started doing more work in the defensive end. Mm-hmm. And despite that, his play improved. And I think when you look at that and you say, okay, he's playing tougher minutes now and he's doing better than he did when he broke into the league, it really makes you wonder where his ceiling is. He's a guy, he could be a 100-point player at the prime of his career.
Well, the Ryan Nugent Hopkins already, and is still a teenager, obviously, 18 years old, when he would, there'd be a possibility of a two-on-one, and you'd sort of see it because you can see the whole ice. What I was amazed by about this kid is that as many times as you see that develop on the ice as an observer and realize that the player holding the puck doesn't see the play. This guy sees the play. He just has I always hesitate to bring up Gretzky because it's totally unfair, but he does seem to have a sixth sense or eyes in the back of his head, right?
Yeah, his vision, his hockey sense, and his ability to read the play is uncanny almost. Robin Brownlee brought up Doug Weight as a comparison early on, and he brought him up again here a few days back. And I like it. I think that's the last center that I personally saw in Edmonton with just that ability to know what was happening with the play and to put the puck where it was going to go. Now, I'm not saying that Nugent Hopkins isn't going to be better than Weight down the road, because he might be, but that's the only guy that I've seen recently that I can compare him to.
You and Robin are obviously forgetting Pouliot, but I'll forgive that. The Cult of Hockey, I always love reading your stuff over there, and you do a lot of great work over there. I noticed that the entire cult is going to be doing some zone possession stuff here when the season starts. Tell me about that project.
Yeah, so you've had Eric T. from NHL Numbers and Broad Street Hockey on a few times. So it's basically his project where he's tracking what teams do to enter the zone. So he tracks which player brings the puck into the zone, how the puck gets there, and what happens. What he found was that carrying the puck into the zone was a much safer play defensively and was way more likely, I think three times more likely thereabouts, to result in a goal or a scoring chance than a dump and chase style. And so what it did was it really emphasized which players in Philadelphia, the team they were tracking, which players were able to carry the puck into the zone and maintain possession. So which players could transition from the neutral zone to a scoring position in the offensive zone. And that's something that's not really being tracked. It's not something that we can really know statistically. I mean, shot metrics and Corsi give us an idea, but they don't give us specifics of who's controlling the play that way. And I think Edmonton is a prime team to look at from that angle, because they do have players players like Hall, players like Hemsky, players who carry the puck into the zone. And I'm very curious to see which guys really excel at it and which guys are maybe leaning on their line mates a little more. Now, the other half of it is also zone exits, and this is something that hasn't been done, to my knowledge, anywhere else. And we're going to track which players are doing the same thing, but in reverse, getting the puck out of the defensive zone safely. So puck-handling defensemen, I think, are often undervalued in Edmonton, guys like Tom Gilbert, guys like Jeff Petrie, because we focus in on the turnovers, but we don't really appreciate how big of a job they're doing moving the puck out of the zone. I watched a game, and I was tracking this. I tracked it a few times last year, and Petrie and Theo Pekham were on a pairing, and every time the puck moved out of the zone, it was Jeff Petrie making the pass. Theo Pekham didn't clear his own end once. He'd get the puck, he'd pass it to Petrie, Petrie would advance it. And, I mean, Pekham's not going to rack up any giveaways playing that style of hockey. And so by looking at who's moving the puck out of the zone, we can kind of put giveaways in context. We can understand which players are coughing up the puck, but why they're doing it, because they're being relied on to advance it.
And then you've got forwards, Jonathan, like Aleš Hemsky, who are like, give it to me, baby. I'm going to take it, carry it into the zone, maybe do a curl or something, but I'm going to gain possession that way. That should show a higher value for guys like Hemsky and Taylor Hall then, too.
Yeah, Hemsky was the guy up front that I was specifically thinking of, because he does some things. Like, we've all seen him go 1-on-4 and side a little bit when he loses the puck, but he carries the puck into the zone. He gets the attack set up more often than I would guess anybody else on the team, though I don't know that because we haven't tracked it yet.
Jonathan, thanks for this, buddy, and we'll have you back soon again.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Alan. Thank you.
All right. That's Jonathan Willis, who is, of course, from Cult of Hockey, Copper and Blue, Oilers Nation, and more. He gets around because he writes so much, and he does not have the personal habits of Ernest Hemingway. So there's every chance he'll be here in the fall. You don't know about Hemingway?
I tried to Wikipedia it, but I gosh.
See, that's what the great thing about your generation is. You could read like a Hemingway book and then you would know a little bit about his style and why he's special. But no, just I have no time for that. I'm busy. I got to get to Wikipedia. You know, there you go. I think there's even a movie that might help you with him. But anyway, interesting sort. We've got Corey Graham coming up. Oil Kings play-by-play guy, excited about the season just around the corner. We'll check in with him next. This is Nation Radio, brought to you by Edmonton Motors.